He is Robin Leach. He is Jada Markin.
This is Car Keys. Baby, you can drive
my car. Good morning to our listeners for this week's Car Keys show. We often pride ourselves, Jay and I, in being able to spot new vehicles that we talk about maybe prior to ever seeing them, but shortly after they arrive in our Northwest Broadcast Corner. And to that end, a sighting of a Tesla Cybertruck was seen prior to this week's show being taped in our Northwest Connecticut Corner, actually over the line in Millerton, New York, stopped at a red light and with Florida plates on it. So the Cybertruck is on the road. We know it's been on the road, but I had not seen one in our corner until this last week. End of this show. And that's it for that particular topic on the sighting. But there's something on YouTube or about a Tesla being stuck in sand in Nantucket. And it got me thinking about what, and Jay may help on this because I think he's driven a Rivian, or maybe he hasn't, but I was curious as to why that might have happened, and I don't know how it happened, so this is a conjecture on my part for this topic, because I have driven in sand in an all-wheel drive vehicle, or my Jeeps, or Broncos, actually, a long time ago, and I do know that driving in sand can be problematical if you don't really know how to drive in sand. I presume this Tesla was a dual motor, this Cybertruck was a dual motor one, which would have given it four-wheel propulsion. But to see it, the picture of it embedded in sand, made me wonder whether the driver had no clue how to apply accelerator force to four wheels in sand. And driving in sand is a bit different than driving on hard pavement. Jay will agree with that, I know. And and that could happen to any all-wheel drive vehicle, not just the Cybertruck that I saw the picture of. But it was interesting that it got stuck. And my only thinking was, and this is for you drivers who drive in soft terrain, which could be mud, swamp-like land.
Let me interrupt here, because I think that we don't do a heck of a lot of sand driving in
our
neck of the woods. And the only sand driving I've done is on the Florida beaches, and it's pretty uneventful. It's actually pretty crazy, a pretty lazy way to go and sit on a beach, if you ask me. But that's what they do. Other than that, we don't spend a lot of time in sand. But to the point of the Cybertruck, there's one that sold. I was just while you were talking, I was researching it, the sale, and I guess people are still making money with the first Foundation series, the first trucks to come out. As one just sold on Bring and Trailer for $160,000, which I think is substantially more than what the list price is on those trucks. So, for now, if you were on the list and you did get, and you are one of the first recipients or took delivery of one of the first Cybertrucks, you can still flip them and make a few pennies.
To that point, that's interesting because this happened in the electric car world in general, with early demand for electric cars exceeding, in some cases by far, the availability of such vehicles, and they were marked up by dealers, normally known as ADMs, and that happens in lots of special vehicles that come available to buyers, whether they're electric or whether they're fossil fueled. A problem with some of these vehicles is that after the excitement dies down and the production catches up, those people who have gone and bought something like Bring a Trailer, making somebody the first user or recipient of one of these specialized vehicles, whatever it may be, that may be not a very good investment over the long haul. And that's one of the things I think the Cybertruck is going to prove to be interesting to watch. Jay and I have talked a lot about it. It's practicality. Apparently, Motor Trend thinks it's a pretty practical pickup truck when used properly. And there are people that just love to get hold of these first vehicles as fast as they can. And if they aren't the first recipient, they go and do something like Jay's example just mentioned, which is buying it off Brigham Trailer, and somebody made probably a hefty profit on it, unless the first person paid a lot more than the price. I believe they started around $70,000, but go up rapidly.
Yeah, but the Foundation Series is the initial fully loaded truck,
yeah,
and I'm sure.
Of course.
I'm actually trying to find a list price on it. Well, here we go. The list price for the vehicle was $2,000. So somebody made the difference between 160 and 102. But that's neither here or there. That happens with quite a few high-end vehicles these days. It's hard to buy to get a what they call an allocation production slot for Porsche, for instance, 911, and people who get them are regular customers. When they get the car, they just turn it and flip it, or they put an order in for one a year, and you know every year they flip a one-year-old car. And if you can get into that position, great. Some manufacturers have put the kibosh on that. I think, and we've talked about this before. GM with I think the new Corvette, when it came out, put the warranty would not be transferable if the vehicle was sold within the first year of ownership,
right.
And that kind of slowed down all the speculation on the new vehicles.
Well, for those who have a lot of money, there's no problem with this kind of purchase and desire to purchase and ability to purchase.
Well, that's true in the car world, in the real estate world. If you have
absolutely
a lot of money,
correct, in the real estate world as well.
So for the people, the more plebeian people, I've been looking at, you know, at what new vehicles are out there. There's not, I can't get excited by a whole heck of a lot. Subaru just came out with a new Forester, which is just a new, you know, an upgraded version of what they've been doing for you know, decades now. Still the same flat four, 180 horsepower, kind of sluggish four-cylinder with a CVT transmission. What drives me nuts, and I know I'm going on my own rant here, is that a lot of these CVT transmissions, continuously variable transmissions, transmissions with no defined gears. That is the whole idea of those transmissions, so that the engine is always in a sweet spot in its power range, and the RPMs are not moving a whole lot. Now the manufacturers are adding fake gears, and in the case of the Subaru Forester, they have like eight fake gears if you're trying to accelerate hard, which defines the whole purpose of having a CVT. In my opinion.
Well, I will chime in here by saying don't use it if you want, knowing that having eight fake gears and you use them is going to cut down on the efficiency of the CVT. It's sort of like a lot of these gadgets that the car manufacturers have put in the stop-start situation at stoplights too. Some people don't like that, and I just say, well, if you don't like it, don't use it. And you have that option
in
these CVT transmissions.
In the case of the CVT transmission, you don't have that option. If you're driving smoothly, it will just stay it will be in that slightly moving gear so that your engine RPMs are pretty constant. But as soon as you step really hard on it, it will simulate gear shifts.
I haven't driven one. I thought maybe there were paddle shifters on the wheel, which is what you might have been using for that kind of thing in the Subaru lineup.
There are, but it will shift even without the paddles, shift, if I may say. Anyway, that's just my take on it. You know, we don't floor our cars from stoplight to stoplight in this area anyway. First of all, we don't have many stoplights, so we just cruise along our roads.
I'll echo that by saying, why buy all these fancy, super high-powered vehicles? Because most people don't do that either with these cars that now can accelerate electric maybe 0 to 60 in under 3 seconds. it's one of these things where you have a, well, my car can do it thing to talk about, as opposed to whether you actually do it when you own these cars. And I don't think very many people who buy the extra high-powered or extra fast Teslas for $10,000 to get a half a second faster acceleration to 0 to 60, which is the sort of standard way they talk about speed capability, acceleration capabilities, ever use it once they've had a fun time using it, just to show off to their friends. So much for that.
0 to 60 in less than 3 seconds physically hurts your body.
I haven't had the pleasure of experimenting with that, but, you know, so be it.
So be it. So what else do you have on,
well,
on your list?
Well, there's been a lot of rain lately, or we've had a lot of rain, and I have several cars with windshield wipers on them that have come to the end of their effectively useful life, because you don't tend to change wipers very often or when they should be changed, and a couple of them, this is sort of a safety tip ahead of the safety tip part of our shows, but windshield wipers, when they don't clear the windshield very well, especially when you have torrential rain, is the first indication that maybe they should be changed. Windshield wipers are not expensive. The biggest problem with windshield wiper purchases, in my opinion today, is that many cars come with different size wipers for the driver's side and the passenger side, which is sort of a nuisance. You used to have windshield wipers that were the same, the blades were the same length, whether it was no matter which side of the car you were replacing them on, and you just went and bought a two-pack. Now you've got to go look at a book, and it's hard to tell when you're looking at your wipers from inside the car what the lengths are. But further than that, if windshield wipers, the rubber dries out, and when the rubber dries out, cracks get into the blades, and therefore you start getting streak clearing of your windshield, which can be very annoying visually in rainy conditions.
By the way, same is true for tires. I just went in with my older car to have it serviced this week or last week, and my tires are in perfectly good shape as far as tread wear is concerned, but are showing signs of cracks because they are older tires, and the car was not driven a lot before I bought it. And so if you have, just like you, Robin, a fleet of cars that doesn't, you know, that you don't drive very, very regularly and have older tires on the car, it might be a good idea to change them even if they're not worn. I mean, it's the same idea. Rubber does not age well.
Absolutely correct. Last week, so I was going to bring up a AAA discussion about tires, and one of the things that was in the article I read about AAA from the AAA magazine was that tires 5 years or older tend to be tires that might start to show those particular signs that you saw in the tires of the car you took in. And I know right now I am driving one of my cars so that I know the tires are 15 years old because I only have 30,000 miles on the tires. The car hasn't been used very much, and they too have showing signs of dryness in the sidewalls.
Which car is that, Robin?
The RX-7. And furthermore, that when the tires dry out, the ride gets rougher. The tread is fine. They're almost like they're brand new tread depths. And I too will probably have to go replace those tires if I want to use the car with any frequency going forward, because the last thing you want to do, and I've seen numbers of people on the sides of the roads with flat tires recently, and so I don't know whether the tires are worn out or whether they're actually picking up nails or they're getting rubber cuts. But this is the tire safety is thing we've brought up in this show most of the time, discussing the tread wear and not having enough tread depth for effective contact with the roads and less than ideal weather, which I guess is dry and sunny. Listeners, if they care about their tires at all and their safety, they should go check their tires with more than just the tread depth situation. Because if the sidewalls show cracks, that can become a problem later on without notice, without much notice to the driver that something's going to happen.
And going on another tangent here on tips on tire buying, you know, we a lot of people tend to think, you know, certain brands are better than others, which they are, but within a certain brand, there are very different types of tires for the same car models. And I think it's a good thing to do a little research prior to getting tires installed. And I know I spend a lot of time on a website called Tire Rack. It's one of the biggest tire, if not the biggest tire warehouse in the country. And I've bought tires from them, but they offer a lot of research data online comparing different tires for, you know, what can be the same vehicle. And a lot of the local shops, not all, but some of these local shops work with this with Tire Rack directly. So you can order tire racks and have them shipped to a local shop that you trust to put them on. They're affiliated vendors, if you will. So that's always one good way of shopping for tires. I know you, Robin, have gone, you know, you can go to BJ's and get good prices on tires. There are a few factory outlets with better pricing on tires. But before you settle on a tire, do a little research.
Well, some tires can also come, and Town Fair Tire is another named operation in our listing area, which is also, and there are several others around, all specializing in tire sales, and at one point or another, they all try to tell you that they're going to give you the best price no matter where you shop for tires, which is just a nuisance. And I don't really recommend that you really try to price shop tires. What you really want to know is that the people who install the tires know what they're doing to install them. Some places, if they don't have a reliable employment of people that have been around for a while, just get people to come and service them. I'm not sure that this isn't a problem at BJ's, because I often go there and I find different people, and I don't know how much experience they've had when they're doing tires, but balancing tires, wheel balancing is a real issue. That's usually the responsibility of the installer to make sure that the wheels are in good balance. And they have balancing machines, but it's the location of the weights and the weight and where they put them on the tires that's crucial to the tires not wobbling or giving you a little steering wheel shake at certain speed levels once you've had these new tires installed. And so proper alignment and proper balance are two crucial elements of successful tire installation, so wherever you get your tires.
Well, the good news is most shops have upgraded equipment to do all these installations, because all these newer, alloy rims, big rims, necessitate, you know, specialized equipment to put them on. And most cars now come with very big rims and big, wide tires. And they all cost a lot of money, by the way. And again, and by the way, if you're shopping for another tangent on a tangent, the biggest rim available is not necessarily the best one to go with. You know, this 20, 21-inch, 22-inch rims is becoming a little ridiculous with tire. And I know Robin agrees with me with, you know, these 35 series or 40 series tire walls that you just, you know, easily crack in our potholes. I know you agree with that, Robin, right?
I do agree with that. I am not a big... Lots of times when you're buying some of these exotic cars that they come with the larger wheel sizes and therefore tire sizes, and you have less rubber between the actual vehicle and the patch, the contact with the pavement, because as you get bigger wheels, you don't necessarily get the same amount of rubber compound at the tread level of the tire, because the cars have to go ride at a certain height, and the bigger the wheel, the less rubber there is between the tire and the road and the car. Whether or not you want to have all these fancy sport wheels and sport treads and all that on passenger cars, I'm talking primarily. Let's not bring this into the pickup truck situation and the off-road Jeeps and the Broncos that you see with these big tires high off the ground. And the tires have plenty of tread and rubber compound between the vehicle and the wheel. But I do agree with you, Jay, on your summation of that particular topic.
So, going from one thing to another, I was at Lime Rock Park this past weekend, and it was a small club event on one hand and a gathering of the Vintage Car Club of America. So a bunch of vintage racers were there, but it was a small event. I think they did a little racing at the end of Saturday, but mostly just, you know, driving on track with very old vintage cars. And I have to say, it's pretty cool to see mostly, you know, old cars are usually owned and maintained and driven by older people. And it's kind of cool to see the passion that these people have for these old vehicles. And some of them are just pieces of art. Others have a history. There were two cars there, for instance, and two cars that I've seen here on a regular basis, you know, around the vintage festival time. one is a Bugatti, and the other one I honestly forget because I wasn't born in the 30s and really don't remember cars of that time. But those two cars were sitting side by side in the paddock and driving on the track together. And the owners were telling me that back in the 1930s, those two cars had raced together on track up in New Hampshire at Mount Washington. So I just thought that was pretty cool. Car history, automotive history is a cool thing, and it's nice to see it happen right here locally. The Historic Festival is still months away, but in the meantime, we'll have a pretty cool Memorial Day weekend at Lime Rock coming up in a couple of weeks.
Well, the nice thing about those cars, of course, they don't go the faster speeds of the modern race car, and they're wonderful to watch go around in packs and on a track like Lime Rock. And you're right, the Festival of Speed? Where do they have the Festival of Speed event? That's not in Lime
Rock. That's a vintage festival or historics festival on Labor Day weekend.
Yeah.
So we're a bit away from that, but this was kind of a taste of what's coming up. There were not all that many cars, but it was a relaxed atmosphere. You could see the cars up close, talk with people. It's just a nice experience, and it's pretty easy. I don't know what the policy, honestly, at the track is for these semi-private events. I think you can, if you just walk in, you can pretty much, you know, sign a waiver at the entrance and go down in the paddock and sit on the hill and, you know, cruise around. So we're lucky to have that.
I'm just pulling up the AAA article, When to Replace Your Tires, to go back to this discussion about sidewall aging and tread wear and all that. they have a number of other things, signs of tire damage, worn tire treads, slipping and stopping, sidewall cracks, bubbles, bulges, and breaks. Oh, let's talk about bubbles briefly. Bubbles are usually caused by sidewall damage. You cut a corner too quickly and hit a curb with the sidewall, and nothing happens. The tire doesn't necessarily go flat, and you don't necessarily think much about it after caused this impact between a sidewall of a tire and a curb. But if you don't look at your tires periodically, you will not see these bulges. And the bulges, actually, they're pretty survivable, I've noticed, because I had a bulge in one of my tires.
The tire.
What?
They can also be on the inside.
Well, they're not going to be on the inside as much as they're going to be on the outside. But yes, Jay, that's correct. They can be on both sides, but you don't impact the inside of a tire very often unless you hit a rock. a big boulder or a rock, a big rock that you might go over with your car, and the inside of the tire would be impacted by that rock as opposed to an outside curb. But if you see a bubble on the side, it's wise to replace the tire. And when you're replacing tires now, you have often, you know, you've got to try to match the tire with what you've got on the car in the tread design and of course, the size. Back to Jay's earlier discussion about his old tires that were old, sometimes the manufacturers change tread designs. I once had four Michelins with a tread pattern on one of my vehicles, and 6 years later, when one of the tires actually went flat, I went to try to duplicate it, and it was it wasn't duplicatable because the tread pattern was no longer being produced by that particular manufacturer. And
Robin,
so what
that
was
car
the
needs four
option?
New tires.
You had all four new tires.
Yes. So I, as we get closer to the end of the show here, I do want to go on to our safety tip of the week.
Okay.
And driving last week on the highway and seeing two cars burned to the ground, on both of them were on I-87, actually, but several days apart. A fire extinguisher in a car, which is mandatory in other parts of the world, is a really smart thing to have. It will not put out every fire. It will not put out a fire on an electric car. It will not put out a fire if you run into a super tanker on I-95 and blow up half the highway and the bridge over you. But if you have the beginning of a fire and you have a fire extinguisher in your car, there is a very good chance nothing bad will happen.
Crucial question, Jay, to interrupt you. Where should you have this fire extinguisher? Not in the trunk. Because
law, like in the European countries where they have them, by law, those fire extinguishers are fixed under the front passenger seat. So
okay.
The driver can just reach out and grab the fire extinguisher.
I'm not aware of where the American cars have that capability easily. That sounds like a custom installation requirement.
Exist. And, you know, do as I say, not as I do, because do I have a fire extinguisher in the car? No. I advocate for it, and I don't. But really, we all should have fire extinguishers in the car. It's cheap insurance. The probability of having a fire in a car is certainly lesser than it was, you know, 20, 30 years ago. I remember seeing cars, you know, burn on the side of the road all the time. But it can still happen. And, you know, whether it's a car overheating, a fuel line, usually it's easy to put out if you catch it right away. Or else, forget it. Car burns to the ground.
Well,
get your stuff out in a hurry and run away.
To close on this, if you buy one and do what Jay is suggesting, you need to know how to use it. You need to know where it is when you put it in the car, and don't forget the entire time you own the fire extinguisher in the car, because those few seconds trying to find out where your fire extinguisher is, especially if it's not held in one place and it rolls around, could mean the difference between successfully putting out the fire and not doing so.
You don't want a fire extinguisher rolling around in the car.
Well, you know, people don't know about these things. They just get them and put them in a box, and maybe they won't roll. But this is just what I say for the listeners.
All right.
Until next week, we are Car Keys.
Next week. Yep. Thanks for listening.
Car Keys with Robin Leach and Jay DeMarkin is produced at the facilities of WHDD 91.9 FM, Robinhood Radio.com, Sharon, Connecticut.